Good afternoon, and welcome to CSIS. It's really a great pleasure for me to moderate this panel today. First, because it's a twofer for me, I am both a senior advisor in the International Security Program here at CSIS and also on the Executive Board of Women in International Security, the co-sponsor of this event. Let me just take a moment to tell you a little bit about both organizations. CSIS, as you know, is a leading think tank here in Washington that is both centrist and bipartisan and working on the range of international and strategic issues. WISE, as many of you may know, is a nonprofit membership organization that's dedicated to the promotion of women in the field of international security. It has members in over 35 countries around the world, a mix of people inside government and outside government. So again, it's just a great pleasure for me to be representing both organizations here on this panel. And the third reason it's a pleasure is because we're addressing one of my favorite topics, and that is how do we actually win this war on terrorism? How do we put together a strategy for doing that? Some of you may recall right after September 11th, CSIS, a group of scholars here at CSIS put out an early attempt called To Prevail, to call for a comprehensive, multidimensional strategy for fighting a campaign against terrorism that would include a strategy for attacking the terrorists abroad, a strategy for defending us at home, and a strategy for also preventing future generations of terrorists from arising. And we've waited quite some time for anybody to answer that call. And so it's a great pleasure for me to applaud the efforts of both Representative Turner and Representative Harman, who are with us today, for the report that they've done on an attempt to put together a comprehensive, multidimensional strategy, an action plan, if you will, for winning the war on terrorism, and also an attempt to begin a national debate on this subject. We really haven't had the kind of dialogue and debate on this issue that it deserves. So I think all of us would want to look at this as the beginning of that discussion rather than the end. Let me begin by simply giving you a very brief introduction to each of our illustrious speakers. You have more fulsome bios in front of you. And then we'll give each of them a few minutes to make brief introductory remarks and then open it up for discussion. The Honorable Jim Turner is serving in his fourth term in Congress, representing the 2nd Congressional District of Texas. He is the ranking member of the House Select Committee on Homeland Security. He's also a member of the House Armed Services Committee and a ranking member of the Terrorism Subcommittee. As you'll see from his CV, he has a lifetime commitment that he's shown to public service in various capacities, especially in Texas. He's also a graduate of the University of Texas, holds 3 different degrees from there, and also a veteran of the U.S. Army. The Honorable Jane Harman is representing California's South Bay region. She's in her 5th term in Congress. She is the ranking member on the Intelligence Committee for the 108th Congress. She's also been one of the designees, if you will, to spearhead House actions in response to the September 11th attacks, and is also the ranking member on the panel's subcommittee on terrorism and homeland security. She's also been appointed to the new House Select Committee on Homeland Security. She also, prior to serving in Congress, has a very illustrious career in public service, having crossed between academia, the legal profession as an advisor and a counselor to various organizations and parts of government, and so forth, which, again, I would refer you to her longer bio. Jen Nolan, who is a fellow board member of WISE, now teaches international security at Georgetown University and is working on a book, I think it's her 7th, on dissent and national security. She's in the prior lives been the foreign policy advisor or director at the Century Foundation, a senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, a senior international security consultant for SAIC, and she's also served in the Department of State, the Senate Armed Services Committee, the National Defense Panel, Defense Policy Board, and I could go on and on. And many of you have also seen and read her very thought-provoking books. So we have just the right panel, I think, to address this very important topic today. And with that very brief introduction, let me please turn it over to Representative Turner to start us out with some opening remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. And I want to thank you and CSIS, as well as Women in International Security, for the opportunity to have this forum to present our document, Winning the War on Terror. I really do appreciate Jane Harmon and her assistance in this project, and Jane's done such a great job and leadership on the Intelligence Committee, been a recognized leader in the House in trying to put us in a position where we can ensure we do not have a repeat of 9/11. And Jan, thank you so much for being here and for your work. I know you were very much involved in serving on the commission to investigate the embassy bombings in Africa, and you throughout your career have had a strong and abiding interest and leadership on these issues. So it's an honor to have the opportunity to talk about these issues with all of you, and I thank all of you for joining us today. I hope we are beginning today a public discourse on how we can win this war on terror, because I am convinced that up to now we've had a rather limited view on what it's going to take in order to prevail. I want to thank a whole host of people who are here, many of whom are mentioned in the acknowledgement section of our report. I particularly want to acknowledge the staff of the Homeland Security Committee. The Democratic staff is very much involved in helping us put this document together under the leadership of David Schanzer, our staff director. Scott Bates, the senior policy advisor on our committee staff, is the prime mover behind putting this document together. And Scott, thank you for your good work on this project. When we look at where we are today in terms of winning the war on terror, I'm reminded of a breakfast meeting that I had with several of my colleagues who just returned from a trip to Iraq, and we were invited by Secretary Rumsfeld to come over to the Pentagon, to his office, and tell him about our experience. This was back in October, and that was the same morning that many of you may remember that the Washington Post published the memo, the internal memo that he had just issued to General Myers and some of his staff, asking some very tough questions about our effort to win the war on terror. The portion of the memo that got the most attention in the Post that morning was the phrase that he used in his internal memo, where he referred to Afghanistan and Iraq as being a long, hard slog. You remember that report. But he gave us that memo at the breakfast because he, realizing it had been leaked, he wanted to be sure we understood what he was trying to do with this memo. And I brought along a copy of it because some of the questions that he asked were the very same questions that I was asking. And it was encouraging to me to know that he was thinking this way, because in the usual press conferences that he conducts, you don't hear these kind of tough questions asked. But he said, for example, I'll give you a flavor of this. He says, does the Department of Defense need to think through new ways to organize, train, equip, and focus to deal with the global war on terror? Are the changes we have and are making too modest and incremental? Does the U.S. need to fashion a broad, integrated plan to stop the next generation of terrorists? Those are a few of the questions that he asked of his staff. And at the time, I was beginning my thoughts about how to put together a strategy to win the war on terror. And so I was encouraged that what I guess is the chief architect of the war on terror was asking these questions as well. So what we have done in this document is to try to lay out what we believe to be the right strategy to win the war on terror. And that involves simultaneously pursuing three missions. And that is, first, we've got to be more aggressive and smarter about how we go after the terrorist, wherever they may be. And under that section of our report, we have a few ideas just to give you a flavor for it. Things like doubling the size of the special forces, creating, as Jane has recommended, a director of national intelligence, increasing the number of FBI agents by 50%, and on. The second element or mission that must be pursued is the one that I've dealt with the most on the Homeland Security Committee, and that is protecting the homeland. And even though we all know we've done a lot, the question is still open as to whether or not we've made this nation as safe as it needs to be. And under that section, we make suggestions such as improving our border security, securing all unprotected nuclear material worldwide, screening 100% of our cargo containers that fly with us on our passenger planes, and on. The last mission that I think we must pursue to be successful in the war on terror is the one that perhaps to date has received the least attention. And that is, how do we ensure that we will not see more and more terrorists coming on the scene, joining the ranks of groups like Al-Qaeda and others? Preventing the rise of future terrorists is perhaps the greatest challenge and the most neglected area of our work today. Under the section, we propose things such as a Marshall Plan for the Middle East to create what I think is the essential building blocks of democracy, and that is a middle class. History, I think, will show us that it's hard to have a democratic society unless there are people who have a stake in it, and people who are in a middle class generally have a stake. We talk about investments in economic development, the creation of a common market in the Middle East. We suggest that we ought to be willing as a nation to commit $100 billion over 10 years in this Renaissance Partnership, we call it, this Marshall Plan, and ask that our allies and the rich Arab states match that money to ensure economic development and progress in the Middle East. We call for a $10 billion investment in improving education for Arab children. And we ask that that be also matched by the countries who would be willing to participate in improving and offering secular education options for the children of the Middle East. We encourage the hiring of additional Arabic speakers in the State Department, an exchange program with the Arab and Muslim world, increasing the size of the Peace Corps, and I could go on and on. We also think it's important to encourage national service, and we have a proposal for that. But all of those missions together, I think, represent a comprehensive strategy for winning the war on terror. And to date, outside of the academic community and some of our think tanks, I don't believe we've seen these kind of issues addressed. And so I hope the document that you have and will take home with you today will provide a basis for further thought. We don't purport to say we have every idea here that needs to be implemented, nor that our ideas are perfect. But we do suggest that we must make a commitment to winning the war on terror, and that this plan is the way to go about it. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you very much. Jane?
Thank you, Michelle. It's nice to be here with you, with other friends at CSIS, with Jan, and with Jim. I told Jim as he walked up here that he's got three women around him, so he's surely going to look good today.
That's right.
Right. He agreed. I wasn't going to let him not agree with me. But I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy to join him as a partner in rolling out this excellent report. This is the kind of work that Congress seldom does. But fortunately, a very fine staff, a very good ranking member, that would be Jim, and a membership that tries to get it, has produced this. And I have seldom seen, at least in recent years, anything as good as this product is. It's not just because it includes some ideas I feel strongly about on intelligence reform. It is because it addresses the issue of winning the war on terror, not just fighting the war on terror. And to win the war on terror, you need what's in here, which includes winning the hearts and minds of the next generation, as Don Rumsfeld obviously knew in those questions he posed to his own staff, and as Michelle has known forever, and too few of us have learned fast enough. So at any rate, winning the war on terror is what's addressed here, and I'm very pleased that these ideas will be out there in Congress in this session. They're also out there in the press, hopefully, and they're out there with thoughtful people who are sitting in this audience, and maybe this White House and administration are listening up, and they'll be out there as they think about how to solve the problems that have clearly been demonstrated on their watch. I just want to address the intel portion of this report because it is a piece of what we need to do if we're going to get it right. The intelligence, as I think everybody understands, is now, I think, the centerpiece of the challenge we face. It is the tip of the spear in the war on terror. If we don't know not just the technical signatures of what we face, but the human signatures, the plans and intentions of leaders who are plotting against us, we cannot possibly prevent, disrupt, and defend against those plans and intentions and threats. We can't do it. This is no longer your father's war or even your mother's war. This is a completely different battleground. There are no standing armies. There are no, or often no state sponsors. It just doesn't look like the wars of the 20th century. These people are loosely aggregated. They don't necessarily look like what we expect, and they attack us asymmetrically. And to be prepared, we need the best, timely, accurate, and actionable intelligence. We are not organized to produce that intelligence either here or in any of the Western democracies or even in our friendly, moderate Arab states with whom we work so closely, like Jordan. We will be organized to get that kind of intelligence if we make some fundamental changes. And many of us on Capitol Hill and people I'm talking to, and I hope Michelle and Jan, have believed for a long time that we need structural change. And so legislation that all the Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee have introduced and that is outlined in here would make some of those fundamental changes by taking 15 different stovepipes. You all understand that word, our current intelligence community. Four of them are the intel agencies of the military services, and finding a way, we call it a virtual way, to reorganize them into one effective, well-managed community. And that's what our Director of National Intelligence is designed to do. That person won't move into a sleek new building. That person won't wear a new arm badge. He won't have a huge, or she, army behind him, but what he will have is new statutory authority, new budgetary authority to task and manage 15 stovepipes into one digital organization to confront the threats against us. And that's what's outlined in Jim's report. It was in the Washington Post today that Congress needs to provide better oversight over the intelligence functions. I agree. Congress needs to reorganize, too. Congress has reorganized to some extent, or at least the House has, by forming the Homeland Security Committee, which Jim so ably leads as ranking member. But there are still many more turf battles to win. I would just say that the legislation that some of us have introduced, and again, that's part of this report, and the actions that Jim Turner has taken show that Congress is capable of rising to this challenge. And I just want to conclude that we cannot win the long-term challenge posed by the terrorism threats against us unless we provide long-term strategies. And this is probably, in my mind, the best evidence that I've seen that Congress is capable of it, and specifically that one member whom we will be enormously sorry to lose at the end of this Congress is capable of it. Jim, congratulations on a really thoughtful, excellent product. You deserve as much praise as we can shovel upon you, and then hopefully those who are listening here will rise to the challenge and help you and help the world win the war on terror.
Thank you very much. Jan Nolan?
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to follow these two wonderful members of Congress who have been leaders and pioneers and have clearly established such enormous credibility and knowledge in this area. And thank you also to CSIS and to WISE for cooperating to put together this session today. It's literally an oasis of discourse in a very, very fractionated and increasingly difficult environment for having discourse of any kind in Washington. This report recognizes critically that we face systemic issues that have eluded resolution by any party or any current structure, and that Congresswoman Harman just said, this is a long-term effort that needs systematic attention. The other thing I find particularly laudable is the emphasis on prevention, which is one of the pillars of the report. These are long-term investments in trying to undo the damage and change the perception of the West of the United States in critical regions of the Islamic world. This report also obviously establishes that you can't fight terrorism with bureaucracy, which has been one of our sort of American responses, at least not the bureaucracy that we have. And having said that, let me just say a couple of things about internal reform. I've served on several commissions over time, seemingly all of them, but the investigation of the bombings in East Africa, as Congressman Turner referred to, also a commission that was chaired by John Deutsch about reorganizing the U.S. government for response to nonproliferation challenges, the National Defense Panel, et cetera. There are many parallels between nonproliferation and terrorism, which Congresswoman Harman alluded to, the transnational nature, the inability to have any silver bullets, the tremendous bureaucratic overlap, and so forth. But in all cases, the key thing is the implementation strategy for each of the sets of recommendations and what can be done to carry now the message that has been so well put together in this report through the process, often laborious process of implementation. And let me just offer two final thoughts on that. First, it's interesting. CSIS has a very interesting precedent for having pioneered one of the more interesting bureaucratic reforms of the last two decades, which was the so-called Goldwater-Nichols legislation, which transformed the structure of the Joint Chiefs and has had immense impact on the way in which we organize our military. CSIS, working with the stakeholders, including members of Congress, members of the executive branch, other experts, and the military, very painstakingly put together a consensus that was then handed up, if you will, up the chain of command. Legislation was passed based on building on the consensus established privately, ultimately leading to very successful reforms. That kind of private-public partnership, I think, is something that everyone who's involved in the private sector should offer to these stellar members of Congress to help in any way that they can, to give them the credit but do the work. I think that kind of partnership works very well. It's, I think, John J. McCloy who said that you can do almost anything you want in Washington as long as you don't insist on taking credit for it, or at least give the credit to the people that can get things done. Finally, a note which I think runs throughout this report is the recognition of the tremendous importance of professionalism, expertise, which has been all too sadly downgraded in many of the debates that we've been having. And I offer one small reform for one piece of the internal reform agenda, which I got from someone who is working on how to change incentive structures in the U.S. government, in the State Department, elsewhere, how to think about creating accountability. And her suggestion was that there should be built into the promotion system of people working in government the stipulation that you are held accountable for the way you treat your subordinates. It takes people's hair off when I say this in a senior audience, but intelligence analysts and experts throughout the government just start clapping. The point of it is we need to be able to draw on the full range of expertise and professionals that we have as resources in this country. And maybe that might be one way, a self-interested way, to get at a piece of a reform that would help us to be as informed as we can be. So, again, thank you.
Well, before I open it up to question and answer, I had a couple of comments and questions that I wanted to put on the table as well. One of the issues that I know that CSIS and our Homeland Security Program in particular, it's run by David Heyman, I don't know if David was here somewhere, anyway, has been grappling with is the question of urgency and priorities, sort of where to place emphasis, where to accept or manage risk. You all have put together this incredibly compelling, comprehensive report that has over, I think, 100 recommendations. So one of the questions I'd like to ask you in terms of implementation, which will take many, you know, multiple years and multiple efforts, I'd like to ask a question about what you think the most urgent and important actions to take are. I'll give you my own nomination. You don't have to agree with it. We have been working closely on the issue, very, very hard on the issue of WMD terrorism. And I have scared myself into believing that we are really in a race. This is a term that Senator Nunn, our chairman and now head of NTI, likes to use, that we're in a race with the terrorists and they're running hard and we're not even jogging yet. There's ample evidence that Al-Qaeda and other affiliates are seeking to acquire not only chemical and biological means of attack, but also highly enriched uranium for use in a crude nuclear device. And the more you look at it, the more scary it gets. And yet, right now, there are 130 research reactors in over 40 countries that are sitting there poorly guarded with weapons-grade uranium in them. And when you talk to the IAEA and the Department of Energy and the Russians about their collaborative efforts, yes, yes, we have a plan to look at the first 20 over an 8 to 10 year period. I mean, we're taking this very workmanlike approach to these issues. So, and I have this sense that, you know, 2010, that's going to be too late. The cat's going to be out of the bag, or the horse is going to be out of the barn. So I wanted to, I mean, for me, securing those materials, removing those materials, keep absolutely ensuring that they cannot fall into the hands of terrorists, that is an urgent priority. But I'd like to get your sense out of this report, which is so rich. What are the handful of things that you think are the most urgent and the most important?
Well, Michelle, that is a tough thing, a tough judgment to make. I think about how on our Homeland Security Committee, we're always pushing the Department of Homeland Security to get this national assessment of risk and vulnerability complete so we'll know what the priorities are. And, you know, we hear that it might take them 5 years, and they say three, and then they say, well, we might do it two, and then somebody says, well, we'll try to do it next year. You know, a lot of this, of course, I think, correctly can be guided by common sense. And I think the issue of loose nuclear material is clearly a priority. But there are other priorities. You know, Jane's suggestion in her legislation to create an improved intelligence system, creating jointness in intelligence gathering and dissemination. You know, we don't even have a government-wide architecture to create an intelligence sharing system where everybody can find out in real time who the bad guys are. I mean, these, I could name a host of things that in my judgment are priorities that should be done. Failing to deal with the biological threat. We all know that if the terrorists are still working against us 5 years, 10 years from now, that they'll probably figure out how to be very sophisticated in the use of biological pathogens against us. And we don't even have in our government today the capability to develop the vaccines and the antidotes to the potential bioengineered pathogens that those who are thinking out in the future tell us they may be able to use against us. Nuclear and biological clearly could be catastrophic. So I would put those kind of issues at the top of the list. But we've got to start making these long-term investments. Why should we take the position that we're going to fight the war on terror forever, and we're going to have to make all these annual investments forever? We need to start down the path of preventing the rise of future terrorists. There's about 250 million Arab young folks under age 24 that in many cases are being taught to hate America, who exist in an atmosphere of hopelessness and in poverty, and they're ripe for the recruitment efforts of Al-Qaeda and other groups. So we've got to do all of it. Now, what I think we really need is to regain that sense of urgency and unity that we all had after 9/11. Some people say, oh, well, isn't this going to cost a lot of money? Yes. But I was looking on printout that the Budget Committee gave me earlier this morning. We're going to spend, Jane, you and I talk about this a lot, we're going to spend $4.4 trillion in tax cuts over the next 10 years. And I would just love to have it less than 10% of that to carry out the program outlined in this report. And I believe it could be done for that, less than 10% of the next 10 years' worth of tax cuts. But it's the urgency, the sense of commitment, and the vision that we need to have about what it's going to take to win this war. So that's about the best I can do, Michelle, to answer your question.
That's great. Thank you.
Michelle, thanks for that question. I think it is important because a common human reaction is to hear all this stuff and throw up one's hands and say, it's just too hard a problem. I can't do this, especially in springtime. It is too hard a problem, and we must do this, is my response to that. George Tenet has said that the two major threats of the 21st century are terrorism. We've already had a full in-the-face dose of that, and proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. And the nuclear threat in particular is huge. I agree with you. And very serious and increasing. And, oh, by the way, isn't it ironic that as we were going into Iraq to eliminate the possibility that Saddam Hussein could proliferate weapons of mass destruction either to rogue regimes or to terrorist outfits, and that was a threat that I took very seriously. AQ Khan, a Pakistani citizen, was actually proliferating weapons of mass destruction for money around the world, and it is now absolutely clear that his technology and know-how is in the hands of some very bad actors. Some good news is that Libya is changing sides here in exchange for normal relations, but I haven't heard that Iran, North Korea, and perhaps other recipients who are not states, if there are some, and there may be some, are changing sides. And so it is enormously dangerous. One of the things in this report that I strongly endorse is screening 100% of all cargo containers entering America for nuclear materials. My district borders the ports of L.A. and Long Beach, which are the gateway to 43% of the nation's cargo containers in and out of the country. And I think many people, I would like to say most people who study this, think that cargoes are perfect environments for nuclear materials. The whatever is necessary to make a radiological bomb, the actual bomb, human beings could actually be in these containers, etc. And it is, by my lights, something that has to be our highest priority to prevent nuclear materials from entering our country. And then you're right, we have to secure those nuclear products around the world that we've known about for years. We have not done a good enough job of that. We have way underfunded programs like Nunn-Lugar. This administration suggested recently a 7-point program to contain, reduce, hopefully eliminate the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Good ideas, but just announcing them isn't going to do anything. Funding them, making certain they're the highest priority, will do something, and I haven't noticed that adequate funds are being put toward these programs. One last point on port security and container security. In the fiscal 05 budget is the first of five-year installments totaling $53 billion for the building of silos and equipment for a limited missile defense system in Alaska. I have long supported R&D for missile defense. I support theater missile defense systems like the cost-shared Arrow in Israel. I think they're very significant. But as writer after writer, most recently yesterday in the New York Times, has pointed out, this system has not been tested. It does not work. And 49 generals and admirals wrote a letter recently to the president suggesting that all of this money ought to be reprogrammed for port security, and that would go a long way to answering the problem you just put.
Okay. Jan, any comment, or should we open it up?
Let's go. Let's proceed.
Let's open it up for question and answer. Please. Yes, sir. Please state your name, your affiliation, and your question. Thank you.
Kelly McClanahan, Washington College of Law at American University. I have a question for Representative Turner. With regard to your plan to foster education and to get matching donations from Arab countries for Arab education, how would you plan to implement that and garner these donations from countries that may have non-secular education in their own system, such as the much-publicized textbooks that came out this past couple weeks in the Saudi Arabia and other places like that? How do you expect to get them to donate money to secular education when they may turn around and be one of the recipients of it, or be encouraged to be one of the recipients of it?
Well, I think the best way to go about it is to offer up the proposal and be willing to commit the dollars and use those dollars as an incentive to encourage the match from our allies and from the Arab states that can afford to make the investment. This is, I think, typical of and the issue you raise is typical of the problem that you could suggest may exist in several of the ideas. The ideas of encouraging economic development and having a Renaissance partnership and matching funds for that. None of our proposals are a giveaway program. They all require participation. We think ultimately that's the way they will be most successful. Obviously, there has to be a buy-in here. But I think the piece that's been missing is our willingness as the world's greatest superpower to reach out and try to make the kind of investments that we made after World War II with the Marshall Plan. And I think if we do that, attitudes begin to change. We begin to be viewed differently in the world, and we restore our position as a country that has respect rather than resentment around the world. So it's going to take leadership. A lot of the ideas that you see in this document are not going to be carried out by a couple of congressmen introducing a few bills. This war against terror is the central challenge of our time, and whoever occupies the White House has to see the vision here and be willing to ask the American people to make the necessary sacrifices to make these investments to be able to prevail.
Otto Kreischer, Copy News Service. Kind of a two-part question for probably for Congressman Turner. You estimated that you could do it for 10% of the $44 trillion, which would be $440 billion. But you've got $100 billion for your Marshall Plan and the expansion of the military, securing the borders, all the rest of it. It doesn't look like you can do it for that kind of price. Have you really given any realistic estimate of what it would cost to implement all of this? And the other thing on your public service plan, national service plan, you're trying to expand the military. At the same time, you're offering an alternative to kids to do something. You'll give them some of the same benefits to do civil public service otherwise. And you're kind of, well, it's not a conflict of getting kids into the military if they can do the same thing by doing something here at home.
Well, to address your last question, I think there are many young people who would volunteer for national service in the civilian sector who may not want to join the military. So I believe the our experience in the 60s with the Peace Corps and the recognition of the challenges we face today, I think there are young people out there who would commit a year. And I think by providing some financial incentive, some educational benefit for it, that we could get good participation. Again, it's going to take national leadership. We've got to be willing to tell the American people that winning the war against the terrorist threat requires sacrifice, requires participation. And with regard to the cost, there are a lot of recommendations in here that, you could have a good debate about will it cost this many million or that many million. In our judgment, if we had 10% or even less of that $4.4 trillion, we could go a long way toward carrying out the policies and the suggestions in this document. All the suggestions in this document do not require new dollars. If you look at the military piece, we suggest doubling the size of the special forces. That doesn't necessarily mean that we have to have all additional in strength to do that. We may suggest that the transformation effort that's going on in the Pentagon direct the military toward that. One of the things that struck me the other day, I was in one of these briefings that Jane and I have a chance to be in every now and then, where you close the doors and they tell you everything that's going on out there and research and development to be able to increase our military capability. And I thought about this document as I was sitting there listening to the investments we're making in war-fighting capability. I mean, we are so far ahead of the rest of the world in what we're trying to do that it is hard for me to imagine we'll ever be challenged in any time in the near future in terms of our capability. But we've reached a level of sophistication and investment in military capability that completely overshadows the efforts that we're making and the kinds of things that are in this document. So I think if we try to reorder our priorities, we kind of bring forward the strategy that's outlined in this document, we'll be moving a long way toward doing it. And I think in many cases, they'll be done with dollars that are already there. They'll just be directed more effectively toward the real challenge of the 21st century.
If I could just add something, again, the title of this report is Winning the War on Terror. It's not Fighting the War on Terror. We're very good at fighting wars, but we have already found that our overwhelming military strength, which was so well demonstrated 1 year ago, has not won the war on terror. And that is why we need, however you want to put it, more tools in our toolkit, more strategies, a longer-term view. And that hooks back into the second part of your question. What about encouraging our young people toward national service, whether it is in the military services or some other form of service? This idea has been around for a long time. It has strong bipartisan sponsorship. It is the right thing to do. I have four kids, the youngest of whom is almost 20. I try every way I can to encourage my kids to be involved in some form or other of public service. It was something very important to me. I think our country will be much farther along to win the war on terror, to put ourselves forward as the world's only superpower that takes our responsibilities seriously if we have the next generation in our country thinking about service in the interests of peace and prosperity for all people in the world.
Yes.
Thanks. Bridget Moix with the Friends Committee on National Legislation. I want to thank you very much for the report, and I look forward to seeing more details about the legislation to follow that up. I very much appreciate the focus on prevention and intelligence and the need for focusing more resources and policies on those. As you said, we've figured out how to fight the military side of things. But I tend to see a challenge in that if you focus on prevention, theoretically you're reducing the need for the military action later. But the military actions may actually be fueling more and more anti-U.S. sentiment, and particularly if it's perceived, whether it is or not, if it's perceived abroad as a war that's a unilateral global military dominance goal, which I fear that it is perceived that way in much of the world. And so I'm wondering about the whole frame of the war on terror. And many people said after September 11th, this is an international law problem. These are murderers that need to be brought to justice through courts, and that by framing it as a war, we've actually given them what they wanted and a whole new recruitment ground. And so I wonder how you respond to those challenges and deal with them as part of the problem as well.
Well, I think we all understand that the concern that you expressed, and there is no question that the prudent use of our military superiority is essential in terms of achieving our long-range goals. Having said that, I think there's much that can be done in terms of transformation of our military forces. You know, we do have to be willing to work internationally. We suggest in this document that we need NATO special forces, that we need to try to secure the support of some of the Arab states in joint special forces operations, so it's not just always a Western face in those special forces units. You know, clearly, you know, we cannot proceed down a path where we think the best policy to win the war on terror is a display of shock and awe, which is a word we heard that offended me and during the early stages of the Iraq engagement. We've got to be able to use our military power with a greater precision, and we have the technology and the capability to use it with precision. This report is very strong on the military piece. What we basically conclude is that we need to be stronger and more aggressive and more targeted with regard to going after the Al-Qaeda and other related terrorists that are the problem that we face in this century. So that's an important part to remember. But I do understand what you're saying, and I believe the proper use of military strength. You know, you see it today in Fallujah. We started off talking about going into Fallujah, and then you hear the president's basically saying, well, we're going to wait a few more days. And so, I mean, this issue of trying to use the military option and to go after the terrorist aggressively but not arouse additional resentment is something that we have to be careful about. We suggest in this document the creation of a division of a stabilization force within the Department of Defense, people that are trained to deal with the kind of problems that we're facing. Because in many cases we are have been going down a path of training our military for the type of operations that we're not seeing in the streets of Baghdad and Fallujah and other places. So these are the kind of changes that we hope we'll see made in our military strategy.
I would just add to that that we are at war. We might like to think we're not, but remember, the terrorists declared war on us. They announced it ahead. We should have seen the clues more clearly. There's no question about that. But then they attacked us on 9/11. We are responding to an environment that we did not create. I wish it was an environment that we could have understood sooner, but we did not create that. Phil Hyman, who was the Deputy Attorney General in part of the Clinton years and teaches at Harvard, has written very effectively recently about the notion that we can't stay in a state of war indefinitely. That I agree with. And we certainly need more tools in our toolkit, which are suggested in this very good report, to transition to something else. But I think we have to have military capability that constantly adjusts to the threats that we face, and I think that's important to invest in. And we have to be prepared to use force when necessary. But in addition to that, we have to demonstrate to the world that we really are interested in winning the hearts and minds, certainly of the next generation, at all costs, and hopefully persuading the present generation that our intentions are what our intentions really are, which is to help some very troubled places transition to freedom.
Jan? Just a quick comment to add to that, that I think perhaps the most difficult mindset to change that has that militates against getting effective strategies is the notion that for all of the formidable military capacity that we have, that the use of force or any quick fix is more decisive and easier to use. And though the use of force has its role, we certainly have found in Iraq, but elsewhere in the past, that it isn't easier and it isn't necisessarily at all decisive. It's the beginning, not the strategy. Just quickly on the important recommendation of bringing more people to this country. Many of the al-Qaeda recruits of the last few years are people that would have come to the West to go to college. But for various reasons of economic attrition and loss of opportunity, they're moving instead into these very dangerous influences. So it's an investment in self-preservation, I think, to expose these people to industrial culture, which clearly tends to sell itself, as we found with the Soviets who used to come here and learn.
Thank you. Your question was very rich, and it's inspired all of us to want to make comments, so I'm going to make my comment before we turn to the next one. I think I agree with all the statements that have been made about the need to transform the military for the full spectrum of missions, not just high-end war fighting, but for post-conflict stability operations and so forth. And I think there are many in the Pentagon who agree with that and are taking actions towards that end. But I think the interesting part of your question is that I think if the only or the most visible steps we are taking in the war on terrorism are in the intelligence, law enforcement, military domain, and people don't see much else, they're going to interpret those actions in a different way than if those actions were seen as part of a broader strategy that had equally visible, equally prioritized efforts in this very important third category, which is preventing the next generation. And this is where I think our strategy so far as a country has fallen down in the war on terrorism. We do not have a strategy for preventing the next generation from arising. And in fact, many of our actions have had the unintended consequences of actually fueling the recruitment for al-Qaeda and so forth. So I think that is the richest area where you all really chart some new ground in terms of laying out that piece. Now, some people will come back at you and say, that's premised on this idea of root causes. Bin Laden doesn't care about the Middle East and the Palestinians. Bin Laden wasn't a poor person. He wasn't lacking education. But that's, in my view, a false diagnosis. We're not saying that Bin Laden and the 9/11 hijackers were motivated by these things, truly. But they will use them to gain public support, to gain recruits. Things like economic disparity, things like lack of political channels for expression, lack of liberty, lack of freedom, lack of representative governments, lack of education other than, you know, radical madrasas. So these are conditions that create sympathy and support for the terrorists. And unless we address those conditions, we're going to see the next generation. This gets to Jane's point about how do you transition out of war into something else. That third piece is the only way you're ever going to transition. And that is the missing piece of our national strategy right now, more than anything else. So I think your question is important to kind of shine a light on that piece along with the other important dimensions. Yes, ma'am, right here.
My name is Aubrey Ruby, Georgetown. I'm doing my master's in security studies. I'm also interning at the office of Congressman Peter Deutsch from Florida. My question has to do with exactly what you just brought up, the last category, this prevention, and our relationship with the countries of the Middle East. I see a critical dissonance here, one that Congresswoman Harmon brought up, that we need partnerships in intelligence here with countries like Jordan. One that Congressman Turner brought up, that we need, you know, if they're going to participate in special forces of this sort, we need a partnership. But at the same time, some of the policies and the change that we need to make threaten these countries inherently into the core. And so how do we reconcile, you know, initiatives to bring greater freedom to the Middle East, at the same time reinforcing our need for the pre-existing stability provided by often repressive regimes, and kind of how to reconcile that and push forward in that prevention category without destabilizing further, and addressing their obviously top-level concerns.
This is the $64,000 question.
Would you like to,
Jane?
Well, I'll wade into that, maybe with an answer you don't expect. I think we need to be more clear-eyed about the people we're dealing with in the Middle East, not less. For one thing, domestically, we should be engaged in strategies to wean ourselves from dependence on Middle Eastern oil. That would help us be more clear-eyed, and might even help them be more clear-eyed. But at any rate, that's something we should do. Meanwhile, I think there is a big difference among leaders in the Middle East. I think King Abdullah in Jordan is truly our friend, has taken some enormous risks on our behalf. His father did, too. He is one I would identify as someone we should strongly work with. It's not just the case, but it is the case, that our intelligence agencies get along very well, and that Jordan was a staging ground for some of our operations in Iraq. But Jordan has tried to be a peacemaker in the Middle East and in what President Bush calls the Greater Middle East. So has Morocco. Morocco, you should know, or you may know this, has outlawed Wahhabism as a form of religion. That's the extreme form of Islam that Osama bin Laden practices. It's an Islamic state run by a king, but it is, you know, I think that's extraordinarily courageous that they've done that, and that has succeeded. Turkey is another example of a Middle Eastern country, Islamic country, that has a reasonably secular, moderate regime. So those are three places that I suggest we ought to work more closely with, help more, feature as examples of the kind of Middle East that we would hope would develop across the board. And the strategy suggested in Jim Turner's package would help us be able to do this. One other point that I've made for a while, and I haven't found any real adherence, but I'll put it out again. I think that the Arab League could morph into a useful organization. It is a regional organization of the neighborhood. I don't think it yet has lived up to its potential, but I would like to suggest that if we could help the moderate regimes I've mentioned play greater roles there, it might be that, again, it could be a leader for moderation and transparency. And final point. We should stand up to leaders in the region who don't support democratic, with a small d, reforms in their own countries, and who use the Israel-Palestine problem as an excuse to crack down on people in their own countries, and who don't do enough to counter terror, and who have, despite their denials, moved money to support terrorist attacks on Israel and elsewhere. So I would recommend being more clear-eyed.
Thank you, Representative Turner.
I think we can accomplish the things we need to accomplish if we are proceeding in an enlightened way. This war against terrorists cannot be characterized as a battle of the West against the East. This war against terror is a battle against moderate Islam and radical fundamentalist Islam. And the biggest mistake that Al-Qaeda has made to date, in my judgment, is taking on the bombings within Muslim countries. The bombing in Jordan, the disruption of the bombing in Jordan, the bombings in Riyadh. And when you look at the region, what you see is movements toward more open societies and toward democracy, though the steps are small, and we need to reward those as they're being made. But some of it's been in smaller countries like Bahrain, that now has an elected legislature, in Kuwait, in Jordan, local elections in Saudi Arabia. I suspect that most of the monarchs in the region understand, as the Crown Prince in Bahrain expressed to me a few weeks ago, that change is inevitable. And they've got to be part of that change and lead in that change. So we have an opening here. if we'll simply pursue the policies that we've tried to lay out here, recognize that it's Al-Qaeda bombing Muslim brothers and sisters, and that if we position ourselves correctly, we will be able to accomplish a lot of these things. So I don't think this is a there's a lot of pieces of this puzzle. We've got to be more directly engaged in the settlement of the long-standing problem between Israel and the Palestinians. We've got to always be active and engaged. Even if we can't solve it tomorrow, we've got to be working on it every day. This sends a very important message. So I can see if we do the right things, the keys to victory are here. This is a battle of ideas. And our ideas of freedom, democracy, self-governance, economic opportunity, those kinds of things that are important to every family, every person, those will prevail against the repressive, fundamentalist, violent approaches of our terrorist enemies. We will prevail. And all we're suggesting in this document is let's get on with it in an enlightened way.
Thank you. Yes, sir, in the blue shirt.
Yes, Horace Smith with Human Rights First. I noticed in your session, Transforming the FBI to Handle Counterterrorism, that it appears like you still believe in the FBI as far as its ability to conduct domestic intelligence and also counterterrorism. And, you know, there's been a lot of debate and recently about the idea of the creation of a domestic intelligence agency. And I was just wondering about your thought process about how you still believe in the FBI and its ability to do this mission, also conduct law enforcement, as opposed to having a new domestic intelligence agency.
Well, I'll tell you my view on that. Jane may have a different one. But my view is that the FBI today is making progress in trying to transform. And having watched closely in my role on the Homeland Security Committee, this new Department of Homeland Security spend a whole lot of money and a whole lot of time trying to reorganize in its new configuration. I'm just not convinced that we can afford right now to sort of start over and take this responsibility away from the FBI overnight and give it to some new entity. You can make some good theoretical arguments that it ought to be a separate operation, but just in terms of practicality, some of the most capable, best qualified people that we have to recruit to this responsibility of counterterrorism are people who are in the FBI. And I understand that some of them had the kind of training that's more suited to investigations of crimes and prosecutions, but they're very capable people. And I think a lot of them get it, and I think there's been a lot of efforts made to transform that agency into what it needs to be, and I'm worried that if we try to start over from scratch, it may set us back at a very critical time.
I'm not a fan of MI5 in America either. I think, for starters, just suggesting it formally would create a firestorm that would make the Patriot Act look like some modest little problem, which it is not. The Patriot Act is something that has many good features and some that ought to be revised, and we need attention to focus on that. But I think the FBI under Bob Mueller, the new director who showed up 2 days before 9/11, has transformed into a much more effective agency with a strong intelligence component, which perhaps needs to be separated more fully from the law enforcement component at the FBI. But I think we should even investigate that. The legislation that nine of us on the Intelligence Committee have introduced and that is described in this report in part would take the intel function at FBI and coordinate it under a director of national intelligence who would be responsible for tasking all 15 intelligence agencies, including the intel function at FBI, with our highest priorities. And I think that that will accomplish the mission best, which is to counter terrorism and to counter proliferation.
Okay. Great. Yes, in the white shirt in the back.
Sean Waterman from United Press International.
Could you stand up? We can't see you up here. Thank you.
Sean Waterman from United Press International. I have a couple of questions. For Congresswoman Harman, this idea of a DNI isn't new. I mean, it's been kicking around town for a while. I gather that it was proposed by Brent Scowcroft, at the beginning of 2001 or in the early part of 2001. I asked someone what happened to that report, and he replied, it's sitting in Rumsfeld's bottom drawer. And I think that the institutional resistance to any change of the kind that you're advocating from the Defense Department is likely to be great. And I wondered if you could say anything about how you would try and get through that, and also whether during an election year there's actually any chance of making progress on this. And that last question is to Congressman Turner as well.
Well, let me start with the last part and then the first part very briefly. The terrorists are plotting against us now. And most of us who've studied this issue seriously, and I think that includes a lot in the audience, certainly all of us up here, I don't want to speak for anyone else, but I guess you would share my view, which is that another major terrorist attack could happen in America at any time. So the terrorists are plotting now. They're not waiting for the November election. And when they blow us up, they're not going to check our party registration. So we better focus on this on a bipartisan basis and solve the problems now. And I do believe that this president is accountable for whether or not he takes steps now to fix some of the identifiable problems. And again, we've sent letters to the president. We've tried to highlight what those problems are. On the DNI idea, you're right. It has actually bipartisan parentage. One of its parents is Brent Scowcroft. Another of its parents is the bipartisan, bicameral joint inquiry into 9/11, which I served on. 37 members of Congress on a bipartisan basis endorsed the DNI concept as one of our recommendations. The proposal that we have made recently, nine of us on the House Intelligence Committee, H.R. 4104, would learn some lessons from the original Scowcroft idea, which is classified, and I have never seen it. Even I have never seen it. I've asked him for it, and he smiles, and he says that he can't give it to me, but it is clear that he has proposed this some years back. Our proposal would not create a freestanding department with full budgetary authority, at least in its present form. That's not what we are suggesting. We are suggesting what we call a virtual reorganization, which would have one person in charge who would direct a small management agency that would task across the intelligence community so that the critical missions are both funded and executed. And as I said, I think that they are counterterrorism and counterproliferation. The individual agencies would still exist. They would still be in the budget system. But what would change is their day-to-day missions, the way they hire, the fact that joint assignments become all of a sudden prized and required to advance rather than, you know, staying in your stovepipe and just serving your master. And we would create common databases, you know, fuse technology and capabilities that don't exist now. And I think that this concept is much more likely to get serious attention in the Defense Department and elsewhere, much more likely to work. And if it doesn't work, we can always build on it and do something more radical.
Sean, you suggested that it's, you know, it's hard to get things done in and around a presidential election. I think that's generally true because people focus on that presidential election. But I think that is exactly the right time to talk about what we have laid out here today, because these issues that address the central challenge of our time require presidential leadership. It will not happen until whoever's in the White House or whoever's trying to get into the White House starts laying out this strategy, explaining it to the American people, and telling them that the sacrifices, whatever they may be, are ones that we must make. And in many ways, I know that, as Jane said, we could face another terrorist attack at any time. We ask, what will this cost? Well, what will it cost if we fail to protect this country? It's incalculable. Anything that we invest here that prevents a catastrophic terrorist attack is worth the investment. So we need to be talking about it in the context of a presidential election, and hopefully the debate as we move forward will rise a little higher than it's been the last few days, and we'll begin to talk about this kind of vision to winning the war on terror.
Jan?
I wanted to note one of the very compelling features of this proposal that goes against the adage that if you want to marginalize somebody, you make them a coordinator. This is a very different proposal, and the key elements, which I'm sure many of you know, are granting budget authority, very, very important, and second, creating internal incentives to have a sense of jointness. And then third, though it seems like a banality, it is vital and often the most controversial, which is to have advanced communications that actually create real-time links among the agencies involved. This has actually turned out, in my experience, to be one of the most resisted common-sense recommendations. But that's all of these elements are very much part of Representative Harmon's proposal.
Thank you. Yes.
Tammy Schultz, Georgetown University PhD program. And this sort of goes back to what Congressman Turner just said, but President Bush's poll numbers on Homeland Security and fighting the war on terror still remain high. How would you suggest Senator Kerry sort of take him on and frame this for the American people?
Well, I hope we have an opportunity for both of them to talk about it. And these kind of issues are best talked about in public debates and of the type that we are accustomed to seeing around presidential elections. I think that when you look at, and you can go back and read some of the president's remarks. I was reading a speech that he made in November before the National Endowment for Democracy. It had a lot of the concepts that we are talking about today. It didn't have the specifics, didn't have the plan of action, but I think that when it gets down to it, you read the Rumsfeld memo that I referred to earlier of October. I think there's a general understanding of the kinds of things that you have to do. The problem is we haven't done it. We haven't had the kind of leadership that would lay it out for the American people, say this is the plan, this is what we need to do to win the war on terror, and these are the sacrifices that every American is going to have to make to win it. I suppose we're trapped by a new kind of we call it a war. It is a war. As Jane said, we're in war, but we're not accustomed to this kind of war. We're still thinking about, you know, the tanks rolling across the European countryside in World War II, and that's war. But this is war, and it requires reminding the American people, leading the American people, to be willing to make the necessary commitments and sacrifices to win this war.
I would just add to that, this is not a partisan gathering, and I actually refer to myself often as a passionate bipartisan, that this administration should be measured by whether it tries to solve the problems. Pointing fingers is not a solution, and we are vulnerable, and actions should be taken now to solve the problems. We've made some suggestions in this book, lots of these things could be implemented right now. We still lack one fully integrated terrorist watch list. This president, right now, could make a major effort to get that done quickly. We still lack one threat and vulnerability assessment, which the Homeland Security Department is required by law to produce. The deadline has never been met. It moves and moves and moves. Now it's supposed to be December. Remember, the election is November. The whole concept behind the Homeland Security Department was to harden those places that we view as our top vulnerabilities. That's not a list I would like to publish, but we don't know what that list is. We still have the squeaky wheel theory of Homeland Security. You know, if you yell loud enough, maybe you get some funding. And to Jim's credit, he and Chairman Chris Cox have improved the funding formulas, at least in legislation we've gotten out of the committee, somewhat, but my view is that scarce dollars should go where they're most needed, wherever that may be. If California has no high-threat targets, so be it. I happen to know we do, but my point is, if we didn't, we shouldn't get the money, and we're not there. So there are ways to measure this presidency right now. But if I were John Kerry making some suggestions, I would have him go where this report goes, which is not just to how to fight the war, but how to win the war, and really to focus on what we've all been talking about, which is how to demonstrate, not just with words, but with deeds, to the next generation that there are better alternatives. That is the only way we will truly win the war, and I think if John Kerry goes there and talks a lot about that, that would be greatly to his advantage.
Yes, right here.
My name is Sabine Rosenblatt. I'm the editor of Internationale Politik from Berlin, Germany. I'm a European. Is this not working? Do you
yes,
hear me?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to congratulate on this report because I think it's finally pointing in the right direction. But I also have to confess to you that every time when I'm in the U.S., I'm shocked about how badly informed the general American public is. For instance, I heard that 85% of Americans still believe that Saddam Hussein was behind the 9/11 attacks. And I think as long as this is the case, it's going to be very difficult to educate the American public in the nature of the threat we are facing. And this applies to Europe as well as the United States. This threat goes to all of us, and we have to find the right measures to fight it. And as long as the American public thinks that the war in Iraq that's currently being fought is the right way to fight this terrorism threat, I think it's very difficult to change the situation. So I'm asking you, do you have any ideas to educate the media? Because I think in first respect it's a media problem and the public about the true nature of this threat. And the second thing I want to say, you should think again about your wording, because when you call this the war on terror, of course everybody thinks it's a war like the Second World War and we have to fight it with military means. And I don't believe that military means is the most important tool to fight this war. So it is, as Jane Harman said, this is a different kind of war, but you have to explain to the American public what is needed to fight this war. And I think this report goes in the right direction, but how to get it out to the public that the people understand what's needed here.
Yes. Is that answer?
Yeah. Okay. Let's start.
Well, let me address one point you made, which I strongly agree with, which we haven't discussed yet today, which is Saddam Hussein's role, Iraq's role in the attacks on America on 9/11. There was not a role. There were some occasional contacts between the Iraqis and al-Qaeda, which we now know was responsible for those attacks, but there was no operational relationship. The intelligence, which I have reviewed in detail and which our excellent staff, by the way, I should introduce Suzanne Spaulding, who is the staff director on the Democratic side up of the House Intelligence Committee and who has been very active on these issues for a year. Many of you know her. She was the executive director of the Bremer Commission on which I served. But at any rate, there was no operational relationship. Comments continue to be made by some in this administration that point to this relationship. It is not supported by intelligence. On your other points, I think we've been discussing them all afternoon, and I certainly strongly agree with you that we need to roll out more tools and more strategies. But I do want to make one other point, because I want to be heard strongly to say that we have to finish the job in Iraq. Finish the job means help the Iraqis structure a government and free elections and transition to freedom from the repression of Saddam Hussein. I am not for pulling out of Iraq prematurely. I am for internationalizing the effort. I think it is a good thing that the UN under Brahimi's leadership is there, and hopefully he will help with this transition. That is a long haul, too. Let's look at Afghanistan, where he structured a similar transition and where elections have not yet been held. In fact, they've been delayed for several months because the infrastructure to hold them isn't there, and there's still continued violence in Afghanistan. So I am for making certain that we keep our promise in Iraq and that we do the maximum we can to help, as Jim pointed out, the moderates win out over the extremists in the Arab world and put together and run their own government.
So do you want to?
Well, let me say I agree with what Jane said. I mean, we are in a position where we must prevail in establishing stability and give the Iraqi people the opportunity to have a democratic and free society. I think if we walked away from that, or if we failed in that, it would be a serious setback for the efforts to create a more peaceful world and to win the war against the terrorists. I don't know why the polls say that majority of the American people believe Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, because, as Jane said, the evidence is just not there. Iraq was not a terrorist haven, but it could become one if we fail to create stability there. My perception as one member of Congress is that we went to war in Iraq because we believed, based on what we were told, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and that they represented an imminent threat to our security, and that we couldn't allow that to continue. Having not found any, it's somewhat disturbing to me, one who supported that resolution to use force if necessary to disarm Saddam, which obviously wouldn't even be a resolution before the Congress had we known what we know now, because there wouldn't be anything to disarm. Now, there are those who believe the war in the long term may still be worth it because we got rid of an authoritarian dictator who committed a lot of serious crimes and used chemical weapons against his own people, and that the world in the long term will be better if that society is transformed. I think we'll have to let the historians debate whether we would have gone to war if that was the only reason for the war. But I know as one member, I voted based upon the information that I was given regarding the imminent threat from the nuclear capability that we were told existed there, as well as the stockpiles of chemical and potential biological. But having said that, the issue today, and I hope it's this way, we can persuade our allies in Germany to see it as we see it, and that is we are where we are, and we've got to move forward. And we've got to prevail, we've got to give stability there, and we need the support of the world community to get there.
I think your question points at another key gap in our current approach to the war on terrorism, and that is the lack of a national-level dialogue, really. I can't recall a time in history when we have gone into such an important campaign against a tenacious adversary, that one that will require national commitment, sustained many years of action, where we haven't had a sort of national debate, national discussion about how best to win. After 9/11, there was sort of a veil of silence that descended, and it was understandable for a short period of time that we all wanted to rally around the president. We all wanted to come together as a nation and show our solidarity in the face of the attack. But I think to carry that as long as it's carried is very damaging. I think the most democratic, the most patriotic thing we can all be doing is coming to events like this, writing reports like this, having discussions that say, okay, we're all committed to the same objective, but how best can we actually win? And we still haven't had that debate and that discussion. And I think that shows. So I applaud, John Hamry likes to say the way to turn, ideas into national commitments is to get Congress involved on a bipartisan basis. And so I really think that you've done a great service, not only substantively in terms of putting this agenda forward, but in terms of providing a vehicle that will engage your colleagues in this national discussion that we sorely need to be able to win. Unfortunately, we are out of time today. We could go on, I think, for most of the afternoon, but I thank you all for coming. Please join me in thanking our panelists for a very rich and thought-provoking discussion.